0818 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon. You are very welcome to Liveline. Katie Hannan with you until 3 o'clock today, on this very, very, very sad day. Everyone has been out, the great and the good have put out their statements and done the interviews and talked about what an incredible impact Sinead O'Connor has made to this country and to culture and to art. And for anyone who is involved in activism, she stood with so many people, victims and survivors, and meant so much and inspired so many. But she was somebody that we all felt we all felt we knew her in some way. And some of us did meet her. I want to go to Margaret first. Margaret, good afternoon.
Hello, Katie. How are you?
Margaret, your engagement with Sinead goes back, is it 22 years?
I'll tell you now, it was just before the smoking ban came in. I think it was about 2000.
Right.
And so that's 23 years ago, Katie.
Right. Tell us, where were you?
Well, I was in St. Pat's in Dublin, St. Patrick Psychiatric Hospital. And, well, the only reason I was there is because we'd be HI at the time. But anyway, I was in there because I was an alcoholic. I'm an alcoholic, recovering alcoholic. And, you know, it was something that came on me very quickly and was very violent and aggressive, and nobody really knew what to do with me. And I ended up anyway in St. Pat's in Dublin. And I remember I went up there, it was actually by taxi ambulance on New Year's Eve. No, I know the date, New Year's Eve. 2000.
New Year's Eve 2000, okay.
So, yeah.
And had you been in there very long when you had this encounter?
I was there a couple of weeks. I was just kind of getting the run of the place. But, you know, as you can imagine, like, I was in a terrible state of confusion and grief and all of that carry on. And, yeah, I was there about 2 weeks when I met Sinead, yeah. And okay. It was one day I was... you know, like, I mean, it was a lovely place, really, because you weren't held back. You could walk around, and there was a lovely coffee shop. You could go down there for a cup of coffee to get away from whatever. And I was walking down, and there's a big entrance hall into it. And I was walking over towards the coffee shop, and the next thing I see this little figure in a black suit sitting in the corner crying. And when I went closer, I realised it was Sinead O'Connor, and she was wearing her priest's outfit. But she was so terribly upset, and, like, I didn't even think twice. I just went over and I just knelt down in front of her and I caught her hand. And I said, "Are you all right, Sinead?" And she said, I'm not. And I said, "Would you like to come for a cup of coffee?" And she said, "I'd love it." She said, "Have you faith?" What did she say? She said, "I've no money." And I went rooting anyway in my bag. No, I hadn't much, Katie. But I found a tenner anyway. Well, I said, "I've money for coffee and I've fakes." So off in the two of us went anyway. And she said, "Will you go up and get the coffee?" I said, "I will." And I went up and I got two fine strong cups. And we came down anyway and lit up the fakes. I told her they were 50 cents. But we got talking, right? And now that conversation will remain private because we decided that on the day, and I've kept that to this day, so I don't intend breaking that now. But it was just a kind of, both of us seemed to be in such a dark place, and really what we spoke about was, how did we get there? Or better again, how are we going to try and get out of it? And she spoke and she told me her story and she held back nothing. And, you know, it just flowed the conversation, and I spoke with her and I was trying to comfort her. And then she asked me, you know, what was my story? And I was trying to, Margaret is my name, but like I've never been called that in my life. My nickname is Mabby, M-A-B-Y, christened. My sister couldn't say Margaret. So that really stuck on my life. And she was saying, maybe. I said, no, Sinead, it's Mabby. And it went out, you know, we had some funny, there were times like we were actually laughing and we were crying. But she did share something very, very poignant, I suppose, is what I'd call it, with me. And I had no answer for her, Katie. And the only thing that came into my head was a joke that my sister told me years ago, and it was the driest old joke. I said to her, did you hear about the two mushrooms on the Ryanair flight? And she kind of looked at me as if to say, no, she said, what about them? And I said, one said to the other, there's not mushroom in here. Well, Katie, she started laughing. And it just broke that whole, like, it was like we weren't there at all, that we were going into another place. Do you know what I mean? But what struck me so much about her was her complete honesty and, like, her humility. And she was more interested now in my story and what had happened to me. And, you know, you could see how kind she was when I was chatting away and she held my hand. And, like, the time, I don't know where that 3 hours went. I really don't know. But, you know, eventually the coffee shop used to close there, I think around whatever time, 2:30 or 3 o'clock. And they were getting angsty above, and her driver was standing at the door. And he was kind of walking over and walking away again. But eventually he said, we better go, Sinead. And she said, yeah, I suppose. And she said, Margaret, I sent him out for fags, yeah. And I said, do not, I'll be grand. And she just got up then and she gave me a big hug. And, I've heard stories about her hugs there the last 24 hours and they're all true. Mm-hmm. But she said, thank you so much for being with me. She said, I feel so much better. And I said, Katie, that's true way. I'm so happy to talk to you and I wish you so much love. And she said, I'm playing down in Cork next week. She said, will you come? And I said, I don't think that I'll manage to get out of here before then. But I said, we'll cross paths again. And I said, I've one small favour to ask you. And she said, what? And I said, any chance you'd sing one verse of Nothing Compares to You? She started outside the door anyway, at the top of her voice, Katie. And the man driving the car was throwing his eyes up to heaven and looking everywhere. As if to say, I don't know what as if to say, but... And she gave me another hug, then, and off she went. And I came back. And I went up back to where I was supposed to go. And, you know, I was so deeply touched by... Now, I'll tell you, I found it difficult to look at her straight in the face because she was just so beautiful. Mm-hmm. She was so beautiful. And that's really what I have to say about Sinead. And I'm heartbroken today and... We all are, Margaret.
We're all heartbroken. Thank you so much. An incredible moment, an incredible few hours you shared with her, and a beautiful story, Margaret. Thanks so much for calling in and sharing that.
Could I just say one little thing? And I know it's not relevant to what we're talking about, but this week, for some reason, you know, I've been speaking to people and we all miss Ryan Turbidy so much off the airways at the moment. Great, at a time like this. So, look, sorry about saying that, Katie.
Okay, Margaret. Okay.
Take care.
Thank you for that, and thank you for sharing that that memory, an extraordinary memory. And there's so many people have that special connection. Linda, can I bring you in now? Linda, good afternoon.
Hi, Katie.
You called in.
I did. I made the point that for me, I'm just a member of the public, and so I hope I don't come across too nervous here. So I just wanted to pay tribute to Sinead, how much she inspired a person like me, in that despite all her pain, she was never afraid to speak out, and she was driven, like she was absolutely driven. And no matter what she did or what she said, she always came back, and she always had something more to say and something more to do. I mean, we all in our life say and do things we regret and we're sorry for, but there's something to be said for someone who can stand by what they believe, the truth that they have, and to be able to just speak it out. And for me, she's been absolutely inspirational in that. And it doesn't matter whether she was right or wrong, it was her ability. I mean, she in 1992, when she did that with the Pope's picture, I mean, she obviously knew things, and she had been through her own experiences, and she just knew it was going to take something monumental like this to start a conversation, and it did. And it's something we'll never forget, because it just takes a brave lady like that to just... They're conversation starters. And at that time, people don't appreciate that that's what they're doing, and that's their reasoning behind it. Because ultimately what Sinead wanted, I believe, was to spare other people from pain. And I think she did that right up until she passed away herself, that her the thing about her was to spare other people. And I think she put herself forward and spoke out. And she has inspired someone like me who... I do what I do to get through my pain, and I wish I had an ounce of her just her chutzpah to just say it. And I just wanted to pay tribute to that element of Sinead, that despite her pain, she could have gone in under in 1992 with all the judgment and criticism that came, and she didn't. She even took something positive from then. She said she was able to get back to grassroots. She was able to get back to her authentic self. She was able to start singing live again.
Yeah, she was really. I loved seeing that when she said that that when people say this ruined her career or put a spanner in her career in America, she was like, no, it put a spanner in the kind of career that some people thought I should have, and it put a spanner in the career of some of the people who would have made a lot of money out of her having that kind of career. But that, in many ways, as you say, she.
Yeah, I think what she was saying was that. The real people, the people who saw through, they're the people who came back and looked for her, and they wanted her to sing, and do you know what I mean? And all the people who were afraid to be associated with her by something she had done, they had fallen away.
Yeah, listen,
and all those promises.
Linda, yeah. I'm told we actually can hear this in Sinead's own words. Can we play that now? Yeah, just have a listen to this, Linda, as you brought it up.
Right.
Thank you.
All
people
right.
say that me tearing up the picture derailed my career. But I feel, in fact, that what derailed my career was having a number one record, you know? So I was like a square peg in a round hole, didn't belong in that world. And what I am is I'm a bel canto singer, which means I'm born for live performance. Mm. That's what I'm supposed to be doing, you know? And once I had done that, I'd ripped up the whole pop star career, but it meant I made my living then by performing live, which is what I was meant to do, and continue to make a very good living doing that, you know? So, you know, to me, success isn't about having all the money or having the good name or people liking you or any of that crap. It's are you actually doing what you were born to do and being true to yourself, you know?
That was Sinead talking to Brendan O'Connor and explaining that and redefining, as she did, by the way she lived her life, redefining what success should mean.
Yeah, I mean, she said it all at the end there, being born, you know, to do what you're born to do, and to kind of, she got back to being who she was, and I just think her whole life is a huge lesson, and I just wanted to draw back to that, that she didn't go under, that she kept coming back, and I will always admire her for that. I have read her book, and you can see that this lady felt, she constantly felt things, and she was constantly, maybe impulsively, maybe irrationally, you know, who knows, and but she just didn't worry about what other people thought, and if she could help someone, and if she spoke out and it could change something, she did it. And for that, is why I'm talking about her today.
Yes, Lyndon, I know, because you've said that you would normally not feel strong enough to do something like that, but you're honouring her memory.
I am, because I'm much better with the written word. I can write all day. This wouldn't be my forte, but I actually told your producer, I said, I'm going to be brave. I said, I'm going to do a Sinead on it, and I'm going to come on and thank her for being an inspiration to someone like me, because sensitive people, people who have empathy, and people who kind of, like, I would suffer a lot from, you know, constantly thinking of things that I should have done, that I shouldn't have said, that I... And a person like her, where I go, oh my God, she's so brave, she just said it, she just does it, she just wears it, and you know, so many of us are afraid of what people will think of us and what people will say, and we, you know, that cancel culture that's out there at the moment. And
but you know what, Linda? I think a long time before we got cancel culture, there is this Irish thing where we don't, you know, we don't want to make a fuss. We don't want to make a show of ourselves. And
absolutely.
That's what we, particularly if you were a girl or a young woman, you were basically told to stay in your lane.
Yeah.
So I think that that was her gift to all.
Yes.
To all of us, I think.
Well, I'm nearly 50 years old, so I lived through Sinead. She's not someone that I've heard about. I've lived through her, so I understand. Like, when I was reading her book, I understood her as much as I could from my own perspective, from my own feelings, from my own experiences. And that's what I looked for when I read her book. It's amazing to come across somebody who you can kind of connect with at that level. Somebody who sees something wrong and just says it, or tries to change. I mean, I looked at the story earlier this morning where the travelling community, the school in Dublin, where she was the one who responded, and they had more than enough money. And I imagine that only came out today, and I imagine not many people knew about something like that. And I imagine she decided that they're going to have money and they're going to have a bus, and it was nothing to do with anything else that she could feel. They didn't have the bus. They couldn't get to where they were going, and they were being held back. And that would have been part of her character, was that sense of being held back and not being able to do something because she felt it, you know.
Absolutely. And, you know, I want you to hear this as well, Linda, because this is, again, Sinead articulating exactly the point you were making there about her bravery and the way she approached how she responded to issues. Let's have a listen.
And I think maybe sometimes people got annoyed because I was a bit like a mirror in which people saw all the no's they ever had to say. So many people in this country, women in particular, had to say no when they wanted to say yes to themselves. Do you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. They never got to say yes to themselves. That maybe they would have shaved their heads or dyed their hair blue, or, you know, had a nanny or a housekeeper, or, do you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
You know, babies with different men, or, do you know what I'm saying? Or be open about their anger. Do you know, in particular, at that time in Ireland, you couldn't be angry. Women weren't allowed to be angry.
Yeah.
You know, you could all beat each other up, the men, but we weren't allowed to be angry at all. You know, so I guess I was being all the things that a whole lot of people didn't get to be, you know? And I think that might have been hard for some of them because, you know, they had spent their whole life saying no to themselves.
Isn't that just it, Linda? We weren't allowed to be angry.
Yeah, I mean, that's... Like I said, I lived through that, and I was a young woman myself, and I remember when I had My first daughter, there was still stigma in the country, and I felt that at the time, and I got on with it. And but I know what she's talking about, and it's, you try not to use cliches, and you just that's just the way it was. And I mean, I smiled when she said, you know, she could dye her hair blue and she could, you know, shave your head, and you could, you know, and the judgment for having how you have your kids and who you have your kids with and all like that. And I just think we've thankfully, you know, I mean, you look online and there's all the jokes about Gen Z and Gen X and all like that. But the truth of it is, our generation, as I said to your producer, I said we weren't raised. I said we were unleashed into society, and that we came through. The reason who we are, our generation, is we, a lot of us have come through our own pain, and we've come through real issues, and especially as women. And and I salute and take my hat off to someone like Sinead, who are groundbreakers, who started digging long before anyone. Do you know what I mean? Was,
yeah, she was, as we say, a trailblazer in every exactly. sense, and in the most authentic sense of that word.
Yeah, she was more than feminism. She was a brave person. That's what she was, and I'll be remembering her for that. And I'm sorry she's not around, because I'd like to have heard more of what she has to say and more of what she'd get up to.
Yeah,
you know.
Linda, thank you so much for that. Thank you. I need to take a break. We'll be back with more after these.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Now, I want to go to somebody who I have always regarded with great admiration as an incredible trailblazer in his own right. Andrew Madden, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Katie.
Andrew, I don't know if you'll remember, I interviewed you back in 2009, and You at that stage, that was of course at the time of the Murphy report,
yes.
into the clerical sex abuse in Dublin, in the Dublin Diocese.
Yes.
But you had been the first person out, really, to uncover and roll back that stone because of your own story with Father Ivan Payne.
Yes.
But you had been at the forefront of that.
Yeah, well, I was looking back at the years and thinking, 1992 was the year Sinead had torn up the picture, mm-hmm. and all the controversy around that. And in 1991, I was living in London. That was the first time that I contacted a firm of solicitors here in Ireland regarding my own case. And after some deliberation, I was deciding I was going to take a civil case at the time. And that took between 1991 and 1993 to reach a settlement. And I was doing that with every intention of going public afterwards, mm-hmm. Regardless of anything I had to sign. And but at the time, I did notice what Sinead had done, and wondered what she knew, because I thought nobody knew what was going on.
That was my question.
I had to go public.
That's what
I mean.
But for somebody like you, who were there, you were in the throes of, you know, bracing yourself to go public with this story. And when you saw Sinead O'Connor tearing up that photograph of the Pope on Saturday Night Live, what went through your mind?
Well, I mean, the impact of Sinead came much later. It's in 2009 and 10. I'll talk about that in a minute. But I just noticed it. I noticed that. I thought Sinead knows something. And she knows something I don't, I'm sure she knows more than me. And yet I had a lot of information about my own case and about the Dublin Diocese, and none of which had been put into the public domain. Mm-hmm. And I noticed what she had done, and I thought it was just, there was more to come. But that was 1993, 1994, 1995, I went public myself. And so there was court cases then with Ivan Payne, because there was a criminal case, and then there was all the advocacy around looking for the inquiry to be set up, and you had Ferns being revealed at the same time, and then the Ryan report and the 10-year investigation, the commission of investigation that led to that. And so there was a lot going on. And I was always very mindful of Sinead's commentary and her what she would have to say about those things. And when a lot of other people didn't seem to have a lot to say that maybe should have.
And it was 09 then when you actually finally got to meet Sinead.
Because there was a lot of international media in the country in 2009, because you had the Ryan report coming out and you had out and the Murphy report coming. And particularly from the US, they had had Boston, they had Philadelphia. They knew that this was going to be huge. And they were setting up lots of interviews and they were setting up contexts. And they were coming back to do interviews when the reports were up. And the BBC were in my house one day and I asked them where they were going afterwards. And they said they were going to interview Sinead. And I said, oh, give her my number and ask her, you know, if she wants to get in touch, be nice to chat. And because I knew she understood. And and sure enough, a couple of days later, she rang and she said, oh, come down to the house in Bray. And so I went down to Bray. The first thing I noticed was I brought a bunch of flowers with me. And she seemed to be hugely grateful for the flowers. So there was no, you know, of course you brought me flowers, I'm Sinead O'Connor. Do you know what I mean? There was none of that. Mm-hmm. She was like, I can't remember the last time a man brought me a bunch of flowers. But she was really grateful for them, mm-hmm. you know, and we had a great chat. But more of that chat that day was really about, you know, everything that was going on around the industrial schools and the child sexual abuse and what was to come with the reports. And she had been aware of what I had been doing and, you know, that the inquiry was publishing its report that year. And it ended up being published in November of that year. So we had a very shared common interest in that entire agenda of the safety, welfare, protecting the rights of children. Mm-hmm. And she was very interested in the detail of the activism and how did you get to here and what, you know, when these reports come out, what next? You know, and then we were talking about the children's referendum and children first going on a statutory basis and Garda vetting and all the changes that would be needed and what you do about the church, you know, in this country when all this comes out. Mm-hmm. And but it started off a friendship. It lasted several years. I went down regularly to Bray and sometimes she would come up to Dublin. Then we'd go out for dinner or go to the cinema. So a very nice friendship. So it was a mixture of very serious times because she was very angry in 2009 and 2010. And when the Murphy report came out, she was furious and she really got it. She was furious about what had happened to children, first of all. Mm-hmm. And she understood that mattered and it wasn't okay. And she was furious about the cover-up, that people could actually do that people in the church could do that and that they had caused consequences for so many other children. And she was livid about that. What she was also furious about was people in her life, and I had some people in my life as well, who were looking for grey areas, looking for nuance, trying to explain away, trying to contextualise all this stuff. And like myself, she saw things very black and white around those issues. And you were either on this side or the other side. And I know she had screaming arguments with some of her friends and maybe pushed some people away. And as I had a couple of arguments with friends because of them not getting it. And the other thing she was very annoyed about at that time, she knew she had a platform and she used it in ways that people have spoken to you about and spoken this morning, mm-hmm. around LGBT, trans issues. The women's group in London and people with mental health issues. She knew she had a voice and she knew how to use it. Sinead was furious in 2009 and 2010 that there was people like her, friends of hers, very famous people in this country, who had nothing to say, nothing, not a word to say about any of that. Some people were very good, like Brian Kennedy, Eleanor McAvoy, but other people, nothing to say. And that really, really angered her.
You found her incredibly funny as well, you said, Andrew.
Yes, she was also great fun. And there was so many, I mean, I was thinking earlier on, most of the fun is unrelatable. And, you know, I was thinking, well, I can't say that. And but she was great fun. There was one evening I was down in her house and I was due on Morning Ireland the following day to talk to Áine Lawler about some development. And I was talking about this to Sinead, but I was probably describing things in very colourful language, the sort of language you wouldn't normally use on Morning Ireland or even Liveline. Right. And Sinead was finding this very funny, but also urging me to repeat what I was saying on Morning Ireland. And I was trying to explain to her, I can't do that. You know, you're an artist. You're a creative individual. You can get away with phrasing things any way you like. Anya Lawler would cut me off, and that would be the end of that. And but she was urging me, really, really urging me. And there was another night we went to the Lighthouse Cinema. There was a premiere of a film called His and Hers. Was it His and Hers? A film by Ken Wardrop. And Sinead came to that gig, came to the launch of that with me. And there happened to be a U2 event in the Lighthouse Cinema that evening that we didn't know about. So there was quite a lot of paparazzi outside. And most of them didn't notice her going in. And then by the time we were leaving, the U2 gig was long over. And we were leaving after the film. And one paparazzi guy had waited for Sinead. Mm-hmm. And she wasn't happy about that. And he took a lot of pictures. And she left him in no doubt with her colourful language what she thought he should do with himself for the rest of the evening. And if he was in any doubt, I think her hand gestures helped. And it was all sort of fun. But the other side of that story then, the next day, those photographs were in the in one of the tabloids. But a very vicious article by a female journalist just criticising Sinead's appearance. And I remember her being in tears about that. So that sort of thing used to go on too, which was deeply, deeply hurtful. And she was very informed. I've just been reminded by, I was going out one time for dinner in Trocadéro with the Church of Ireland Bishop of Cork, Paul Coton. And I was due to go out with Sinead around the same time. So I thought, God, these two would get on great. And so Sinead came along and I don't think I got a word in edgeways for the whole evening. And Paul was just commenting on social media, the conversation they had around all sorts of scripture and eight century prophets, Amos, Hosea and Isaiah, he wrote. And well, I was just fascinated. I mean, I knew she knew stuff around that, but the depth of knowledge and to be talked, you know, with Paul Coton and be as knowledgeable about him, about all that stuff was fascinating. Yes. So she was humorous and intense and knowledgeable and passionate and really believed, you know, all the things that she supported them passionately because she believed in them.
Yeah, you know, they weren't causes. She thought deeply and she felt deeply, I think. You know, she was just hugely sensitive in every meaning of that word, I think, She was the essence of sensitivity and acting then on just not feeling it but acting on it as well. Yeah. Andrew, will you hang on for me, please? Because I've got Dr. Mary McAuliffe on the other line, and I'd love you to stay there because you know, many of the things I want to talk to her about, you brought them up there. Mary, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Yeah, Mary. Like Andrew touched on a lot of it there in terms of. Going back, taking us back to the early 90s. And of course, a lot of people will remember, and I know a lot of people are referencing it today online, that speech she made at the X case protest.
Yes, it was. And I remember, I actually was at that protest and I heard the speech, well, kind of vaguely heard it because it's very hard to hear speeches in big crowds. But I also remember, I think it was at that protest that she got into Leinster House to meet the Taoiseach of the day, who I think was Albert Reynolds. So she used her fame to actually approach people who might be able to do something about the things she was interested in and the things that she was really anxious that something be done about. And I mean, Sinead absolutely supported women's rights, women's full reproductive rights. And she put her own self on the line. She was always her authentic self. I mean, she was a brilliant singer. I'm not a music critic, but I think her voice was just had such clarity and emotion and feeling. And it changed over the years. And she self-produced her own records. She wrote her own songs. But she also recognized living in a patriarchal culture, living in a misogynistic culture, that women in Ireland were not fully equal citizens. They could not, validate their own bodily integrity, and she campaigned on that. She inspired people like me.
Can I just say to you, Mary, that there was a time, and if we go back and we both of us would have been born into a country that had Magdalene Laundry still in operation.
Yeah.
And I often think about, how close we are to that generation of women where you were very likely to be locked up if you stepped out of line. Stepping out of line could mean being raped, basically, and that could have been what would land you behind a high wall. But
yep.
I'm thinking that, and this is really what I was thinking about Sinead O'Connor and going back to that time in the early 90s, is that she recognised something that a lot of Irish women didn't see for themselves at that time, because I think there was still a lot of blindness to the true picture of how women were in this country at that time.
Well, I think there was, although the generation who were growing up with Sinead were seeing it, particularly if you were in the urban areas, if you were, if you've left home in the country areas and had come up to the city, and when the X case happened and all the things that happened in the 80s all informed this growing consciousness about women's position within Irish society, and this growing resistance to the dictates of the church and the state. I mean, it was both of them together saying that you had to be this type of woman. And then this young woman comes along with her shaved head and her big boots and her wonderful voice. And she could have just gone on and been a really successful musician as she was. But she wanted to use her voice for something more than that. She wanted to use her position in society for something more than that, because she was angry. She had been through those experiences. As Andrew said, she was angry. She knew what it was like to be somebody who was oppressed or somebody who was, put down for being who she was. And she used all that anger to help other people. I mean, she wasn't just an ally and a feminist. She was an ally to so many marginalized communities. During the AIDS epidemic, she wore the AIDS T-shirts. She spoke loudly about it. When the state was not responding to the deaths of so many young men and indeed some women in our society, and were more or less ignoring it, thinking it was the gay disease and perhaps they were some sort of deserving of what was happening to that community, Sinead was able to use her voice to bring a spotlight on that. She spoke about, she was marching against racism from early in her career. And as you know, a couple of months ago when she got her classic album award, she said, "Refugees, all refugees are welcome here." That was in March 2023. She remained her authentic self all of her life. She continued to help those who were vulnerable, who were marginalized. She was a great friend to the traveler community. She was a great friend to the trans community. She recognized the inequalities in society, and she gave voice to that, and she was just a really brilliant advocate for those who are on the margins of society.
Yeah, and I love that story that I'd only heard over the last 24 hours about the call to Tenny, where she offered the 30 years of her wardrobe and yep. makeup and I'm sure we're going to hear lots more of those private gestures.
Stories, yeah.
Yeah.
One of the favourite things I saw over the last 24 hours on Twitter is that when she refused to allow the American National Anthem be played at her gigs in the States, again, this would have been around the early 90s, around the time of the tearing up of the photo of Pope John Paul, there was organised anti-Sinead O'Connor marches, and she turned up at one in disguise. So she had that sense of humour as well that Andrew spoke about. She was very funny. I met her a few times over the years. And again, I can't really repeat the conversation, but she was great crack and she was fun to be in her company. You know, she wasn't angry all the time and she wasn't serious all the time. She was crack, and she was just a human being who was enjoying herself in the company of people.
And for somebody like you, Mary, before you've made it your life's work, basically, studying and working in this area and researching in this area. She must have been an important person, on a personal level to you, an important figure.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, to have somebody there who was, you know, brilliant and fantastic, but also relatable, a young woman making her way in a society that we were all trying to make our way in, that if you didn't behave properly, you mightn't get the job or you mightn't be accepted in positions. But Sinead would just, you know, she said she didn't really want to be a pop star. She was a protest singer. And if, you know, they were going to mash up her albums, that didn't really matter. She'd just go and do live gigs and make a living that way. She had a fearlessness that inspired. She was able to look the man in the eye and say, well, I'm going to do it my way anyway. And this is what my life is going to be like. And she suffered because of that. She got pushback because of that. She probably lost money and status and album sales because of that. But she always was true to herself. And I think that is going to be what people will remember of Sinead. And she will be in the history books. She is a revolutionary woman, like all the revolutionary women I study in first and second wave feminism and third wave feminism. Sinead is part of our feminism history, of our activism history, as well as being an amazing musician of Ireland.
Yeah. Absolutely. And one of my favourite lines, and I know it's activists have used it over the years, but it's such a good line and it so refers to her. They tried to bury me. They didn't realise I was a seed.
Seed, yes.
It's just,
yes.
It's perfect.
And yes, one of my other favourite ones is know your enemy and know who you're going up against and know, you know, that, you know, if you're campaigning against lack of housing, it's not the refugees coming in who are the problem. It is the policies and legislation that's the problem. So know the enemy you should be attacking and go towards that enemy with a fearlessness in, you know, like Sinead did.
Yeah. What would Sinead do? OK, stay with me, Mary. I'm told I have to take a break, but we have Glenn Hansard and Julie Feeney on the line after these.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And let me bring in Glenn now. Glenn Hansard, good afternoon.
How are you, Katie?
Did you went back a long way, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, I suppose, like, being a musician in Ireland, you cross paths with the rest of your kind through the years. I would have met Sinead in the late 80s in London, when she would have gone there and kind of got away from Ireland and kind of experienced the freedom of being able to, well, first of all, the cosmopolitan thing of being able to be whoever you want to be. And it was kind of just around that rave culture time, and she was big into the Rasta scene, and she had made her record, and things were just kind of flying for her in a really great way, and a kind of a happy time and an empowered time for her. Yeah, back then.
As a musician, the sense that, you know, that we've lost somebody that whose importance to us goes way beyond that. Can you define that for me, Glenn?
Me like everybody else, we're just feeling the profound bruise. Like, Ireland is feeling a profound bruise right now, like a huge kind of like tearing open of the. Of the spirit, and it's got something to do with the fact Sinead died too young. She we didn't get a chance. Like, it's like we didn't mind her well enough, and I know that sounds kind of, we're like, we didn't take care of her well enough, celebrate her enough while she was here. She was here only a couple of days ago, and it's the feeling that I'm walking around with is just like, you know, I remember meeting myself and Sinead were meant to do, we were meant to cover Fairy Tale in New York at Shane McGowan's 60th birthday a few years ago, and I remember when she arrived that day, neither of us wanted to touch that song. You know, she didn't want to do it. I didn't want to do it. And it turns out myself and Lisa O'Neill did it together. And I was really glad and I was really relieved because, you know, there was something with Sinead, like, you know, through the years of meeting her, it was almost like a little bit, you know, it's a tough thing to admit, but it was almost a little bit scary sometimes because you didn't know who you were going to meet because she may have been in a certain mood or she may have not been in a certain mood. And also we bring a lot of baggage to when we meet people of profound strength. And you know, I hear a lot of people talking about how profoundly strong. Sure, she was also profoundly delicate. So there's a kind of a complication in that strength. It's almost as if, you know, I kind of, I sort of feel like Sinead was strong despite herself. You know, she stood up for things despite her own sensitivities. You know, it's almost like she couldn't help herself. She just had to. She, you know, it was like something spoke through her, you know.
Yeah, and I know she, because obviously people will remember you and your advocacy for the homeless, or especially around the Apollo House protest. And Sinead was there with you as well, wasn't she?
Well, Sinead reached out to me around that time, and she just basically wanted to sort of voice her support. And she wasn't in good form. She told me she wasn't in good form, otherwise she would have been down. And I said to her, look, we're doing a bit of busking at Christmas. If you happen to feel it, if you feel it, it'd be great to get a song. And she just got back to me and she said, look, I'll be there. She came down Christmas. She was full of light and full of joy. We had an absolutely brilliant afternoon. And all of the buskers, you know, Bono included. I remember she was like, is Bono coming in? I said, he is. She says, what time is he coming in? I said, I think he'll be there around 5:00. And she says, well, can I go early? Can I sing early? Because I'm just afraid to meet him. I haven't seen him for a while. And I was like, I was really profoundly aware of how sensitive she was to you know, to like, who'll be there? Will I be okay? You know, will it work? And, but then she came and she was the light and soul. And Miles O'Reilly filmed the busk. And actually, I posted it today online just as a kind of, it was a great memory because it was a beautiful memory. You know, and you know,
and what, Katie, she was, like, was Ireland, she actually, we, sorry, was she actually like nervous of Bono at that, even at that point?
Yeah, she would have been. She would have just been nervous about having not seen him for so long, or, and kind of bumping into him. Now, they did meet that day, and it was brilliant, and the two of them had a great hug, and then, you know, and it was a fantastic meeting. But just she just wanted. She was almost like she needed to know the parameters. She was like, I'll come in. What time am I going to sing at? What time is he going to sing at? I need to sing at a different time. Is that okay? You know, it's almost like she just needed me to sort of set the sort of stall out. And then she came in full of joy. But I suppose what I was trying to say, and what I wrote in the on the Instagram thing today, is that, you know, it's like we as a nation, really, I mean, maybe it's all nations, but we prefer our heroes on the wall. It's almost like we don't want to have to deal with them when they're in the room. And I have this profound sadness and kind of anger in a way about the fact that she's gone now, and we're all feeling it. We're all completely filled with emotion, and it's just, I just can't believe she was here only a couple of days ago. And I hope she, I really wonder and worry about her state of mind, and hope she was okay. But of course she was, you know, of course she wasn't.
Glenn, it goes back to the busking days. She actually heckled you at one stage as well, though, didn't she?
I remember we did the other voices, the launch of the other voices, and it was in the Vicar Street Bar, and Damien Dempsey had just come on to, you know, into all of our lives, and he was only a young fella at the time, and I you know, myself and Philip, and had a few guests, and Damien was one of them, and Sinead was one of them, and I remember I played a couple of songs, and she was just, during my set, she kept going, Damo, Damo, which drove me mental. And then afterwards, we had a good laugh about it. But Jesus, it was one of those, I was like, I can't believe Sinead O'Connor's heckling.
There is an awful lot of devilment in Sinead. There's no doubt about that. That's what we're gathering as the day goes on, which is just makes you love her even more.
Yes, no doubt. God bless her.
Glenn, thank you so much for that. I appreciate you taking time out to join us with that today. I want to bring in Julie now. Julie Feeney, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. How are you? It's sort of strange, strange day.
It is.
Yeah. It hurts to know even where to begin. Yeah.
Would you have crossed paths with her much, Julie?
I crossed paths with her, but a little bit like what Glenn said there. Everybody's so kind of nervous, and I mean, I just clammed up when I came near. I was afraid to speak to her. I mean, this woman had an absolutely massive impact on me as growing up. You know, looking at this person in the, you know, there, this otherworldly, indescribable embodiment that she had of this kind of direct line from the feeling of what she was singing to. Make a thing, a capsule of something that you felt was part of you, and that was just the growing up part. And then as a female artist, she was just the ultimate, you know, like she ignited and excited everything inside me, and the level of talent and originality and power that she had, And it also the way that she was just herself. I know that activism is obviously a huge part of who she was, but it reminded me more about being yourself, being your true self, being what you're meant to be on the earth, you know, what you were born to do. That was a really strong thing. I mean, I can't even begin to say the kind of impact she had on me. I found it, like, I'm still, it's been very hazy since the news broke. I haven't really been able to concentrate because she's such a huge force and such terrible sadness. I really want to sympathise with her family as well.
Of course, yeah. And I mean, Mary talked about the impact she had on all women of this generation. And indeed, I'm sure older generations, because she stood for something and spoke for something that, you know, meant something to so many women. But I'm just for somebody who, you know, a female music artist like you, Julie, I mean, like you said, she was it really, wasn't she?
She was it, and she was so much it that the terrible sadness that we feel now, you feel, how can this be? How could I have helped her? How could I have done something? But these things are the indescribable. It's part of the mystery of dying and moving to the next world, and it's something we'll never understand. And that's just me as a music artist. Her family, I my mind boggles as to how they can process it all. But yeah, that's the thing about it. It's the dichotomy. It's hard to fathom.
It is, and as you say, our hearts go out and our condolences go out to her family, of course, first and foremost, and all her friends and all the people that she has touched and are feeling bereft today. We'll take a break.
Joe Duffy. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And I want to bring in Father Brian D'Arcy now. Brian, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Katie.
It's funny, you know, in my mind's eye, I have you on The Late Late Show in one of those incredible performances that we saw that Sinead put in The Late Late Show in the gay barn years. But I'm told you were never actually on The Late Late with Sinead.
I was on plenty of times with Gail and was right down to the present day. But I always watched them from home. I never remember being at The Late Late with Sinead. I met her on a good number of occasions in other places and at award shows and so forth like that. But I unless my memory's playing a big trick on me,
I'm nearly certain it's my memory if there's a memory issue. But Brian,
yeah, I think if I was on The Late Late Show with Sinead, it would have been. It would have been a conversation, I think, and we'd probably been on the same side.
It would have been on an interesting time because, of course, you know, there would have been sparks flying, wouldn't there? Given where you were at in the early 90s, did you get on? You say your paths crossed a number of times.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yes. Yes. I don't have great respect for. She was able to say what I was thinking of saying, but hadn't the courage at that time to say. Because I hadn't even come to terms with myself with the fact that I had been abused. You know, it takes a long time to do that. And I really hadn't come to terms with that, although I remember writing about church abuse as early as 1985, 86, 87 in America. So, I mean, I had been writing about it for 3 or 4 years before the 90s, but it was in the 90s, as you probably know, that in Ireland, through Benton Smith, etc., it came into the fore here. And yes, I had been talking to her about that, and I knew what she was saying had a great deal of truth in it. And of course, I always remember that everyone was looking for me to give out about her the time she tore the picture of the Pope up. And I refused to do so because I think she had I didn't know what she meant by it, but I knew it wasn't just an empty act. And I spoke to her afterwards one night at an award show in Dublin. She explained it very well to me, and I was totally on her side. She wasn't being disrespectful to a single pope. She was being disrespectful to an institution, a clericalism that was not being honest, and that was causing terrible pain to people all over the world, as Andrew Madden has already said in your programme. Mm-hmm. And so that was what she was on about. And it wasn't just child abuse either, because she made that very clear to me. It was about the history of war that had been attached to Christendom down through, and other religions down through the years. Excuse me. And it was that whole injustice that was brought about. And South America, and I'd have been totally on her side at that time, because liberation theology would have been very much part of my upbringing at that stage. And I was very annoyed that, you know, that the church seemed to be more associated with a capitalism than liberation theology across the world. And so that's what she was very well read and into it, and it wasn't just an act of publicity, as some people thought. It was much more deep than that, and it wasn't either that it was simply tearing up. So the Pope wasn't damaged by a picture being torn up. She was just merely making a good shot at exposing the injustice, even in an institution like the Catholic Church.
But there must have been, and I mean, no, people like yourself had to, you know, you were in defence mode to some degree at that stage, because there were so many attacks coming in on the yes, the church as an institution. And you must have had fellow priests at that time who were really, really annoyed with Sinead.
I think fellow priests certainly, but I would have thought, you know, there was a big slice of the population who were totally against her as well, it wasn't just the clergy, I think, many of the laity. And of course there was that shortcut to judgment, which says it's a pop star looking for publicity. Well, I knew that wasn't true, and as it so happened, there was an event in Dublin at RTE was sponsoring at the time. I think it was two of them were doing it actually, it was after that issue, and one of the few people who stood up for in the pop business at that time was in fact Chris Christopherson. And Chris Christopherson was at this award show, and I was speaking to him, and I said, do you know that Sinead is down the hall? And he said, no, I don't. I said, I'd love to speak to her. And I went straight down to the places at a lower place on the table, and I said, Chris is here and he'd love to speak to you if you don't mind. I didn't know how she'd take it actually, but she jumped up and ran up to Christopherson, and the two of them had one of the long hugs that were part of Sinead's life anyway. They had a very long conversation, because Christopherson had spoken out against injustice and the particularly American injustice in South America. In fact, his career in Hollywood ended because of that. And so the two of them had this thing in common, that they were fighting the injustice of institutions and the terrible thing they did to individuals.
Well, that was after that very famous moment we all know of Chris Christopherson coming to her aid when she was being booed on the stage of Madison Square Gardens. And we know what he whispered in her ear, don't let the bees grind you down.
Exactly. Yes, that's right. Which is a Latin phrase, by the way. There's a Latin phrase for that.
We'll hear the English version, I think. Let's just hear it, because it was a big moment in her career and her life.
Ladies and gentlemen, Sinead O'Connor.
So Chris Christopherson had just introduced her, and that was the reaction of the crowd. We just gave you 20 seconds of that there. That booing actually went on for 2 full minutes, and Sinead just stood there facing it down defiantly, and the band tried to start playing a few times. Sinead signalled for them to stop, and then that's when Chris Christopherson came back on stage and put his arm around her, She pulled out her earpiece and responded with this.
right, turn this up. Until the philosophy which holds one race superior and another inferior is finally and permanently discredited and abandoned. Everywhere is war until there's no longer first-class or second-class citizens of any nation, until the color of a man's skin is of no more significance than the color of his eyes. I've got to say war! Until the basic human rights are equally guaranteed to all without regard to race, I say war! And until the ignoble and unhappy regime which holds all of us through child abuse, yeah! Child abuse, yeah! Subhuman bondage has been toppled, utterly destroyed. Everywhere is war!
Everywhere is war. I actually got goosebumps, the hair standing up on my arm after.
It's absolutely incredible. The basis of that is in Matthew's Gospel, and the Beatitudes, that's exactly what she's after, turning out in a much more effective language than the Gospels do. And I think that's what we forget. I mean, it wasn't just about little issues. It was actually about injustice was the basis of much of her life. And also, I think she was also a searcher. That's the bit that I love most about her. She was searching. And as we know in psychology or even in spiritual terms now, the journey is the search. You don't have to arrive at it. And I'm quite certain that until this moment, Sinead never arrived at what she thought was the end of the journey of searching for a place where she could feel comfortable, understood, and what she stood for would be listened to and achieved.
Indeed.
And that was a very difficult thing for anybody to do. She thought very deeply. One of the things that I noticed about her, that she didn't actually think like the rest of us. The rest of us thought within the ambits of that we were brought up. She actually was a rebel from the outside, and who was able to speak her own language, no matter what other structures fought against it.
Father Brian Darcy, many, many thanks for that. And you mentioned there the search, the journey, and that journey did bring her to Islam eventually. And of course, she converted to Islam. And I want to bring in Lorraine O'Connor now. Lorraine from the Muslim Sisters of Era. You were on a similar journey yourself, or had gone through a similar journey, Lorraine.
Yeah, good afternoon. Yes, I did. And as Father Darcy said there, that journey and that searching. It's the constant searching and looking for the answers and, you know, not feeling a kind of a rest inside you, you know. And Sinead, I had the privilege of meeting her. Anne Cassim had just covered the Muslim Sisters of Era in Nationwide. And Anne was doing a programme or some research with Sinead. And she called me while I was in Paris doing some work with our organisation. And she said, Lorraine, I've just been speaking to Sinead O'Connor. And she said, I've been talking about your organisation and she would really love to meet you. And we passed phone numbers and we had some conversations and the similarities of the searching and, you know, the kind of little rebel within her and the rebel within me. You know, our paths were similar in our spiritual search. And we met then for lunch a couple of months later, and her passion for the likes of the Muslim Sisters of Era, and we all know how much Sinead welcomes immigrants into the country, and the fact that our organisation was made up of so many women from different backgrounds, she just loved all of that and about the empowerment of the women. And she, her passion for the work that we did with the homeless, and she really wanted to get down and outside the GPO and help out, speak to the people down there. And from the time that I spent with her, I could see, I think what everybody's saying the same, she had this journey that she was on. Did she find peace at the end with the conversation that I had with her? She felt it was her final journey and that she found the answers that she was looking for. But then we know in, you know, a couple of years later, she lost the most important thing to her. And that was her youngest son. Did she, that blow to her? Was she strong enough mentally to go through that? I mean, we can all speak about that. But I know myself, if I ever lost a child, I don't think I could cope with losing a child. So in terms of her journey and in terms of the time I spent with her, she had said to me, she wasn't long into the religion the first time I met her, and she felt that she didn't know which way to go. She didn't know who to trust. She didn't know, you know. And obviously the media were so interested in the fact that she had turned to Islam. And she was a little bit worried about that. Which way will I represent myself as a Muslim? And I just said to her, represent yourself, as what you have found. And that's it.
And that's it.
About your happiness.
And that's
exactly what she did.
And that's what she did. Lorraine, I'm going to have to let you go because I've got a queue of people who are trying to get in and we're nearly out of time. I just want to say, just in relation to, we're talking about, you know, the stress that Sinead might have been in. We don't want to speculate in any way about that. But if anybody is feeling distressed today with this story, please go to rt.ie/helplines and you will find numbers there that will help you.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Now, I want to bring in Ashley. Ashley, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, hiya.
Ashley, I am looking at the most beautiful photograph of yourself and Sinead when you were, I think, were you just 9 years old in this photo?
Yeah, I was 9 years old at the time.
And this was taken down in Barrettstown?
Yeah, this was taken in the Tree Olympia, actually, backstage ahead of the Barrettstown Inspirations concert that happened that year.
Right. And of course, you were in Barrettstown because you had been diagnosed with leukemia.
Yeah, I was diagnosed with leukemia at the age of 7. And then that following summer, I had gone down to Barrettstown for the first time.
You were invited, you were at the Tree Arena, you were invited into Sinead's dressing room.
Yeah, no, I was invited in. I had gotten into performing myself when I was younger, so she was definitely someone that I kind of looked at just as female artist, you know, in the music industry for in representation and stuff. But I'd made it known like I liked her music and whatnot, and got a chance to meet her, which was huge. And even though it was so many years ago now, because I'm 20 myself now, I still quite vividly remember the interaction. I have to say, it was just that impactful.
What did she say to you? Can you share what it was like?
It was amazing. Like, she was very much concerned about me and, you know, bringing me into the room, asking me how I was, like how I was doing, and spoke to me about my experience at Barrettstown and how it, like my summer day, my when I was on the summer camp down there, you know, like my activities and stuff. And she was very concerned for my parents or me as well, like chatting to them. And she was just unbelievably nice.
And you did recover. You got the all clear.
Yeah, I would have got I would have finished treatment in 2013 and got my full all clear from remission in 2018.
And now you're back singing yourself in Barrettstown for the summer.
Yeah, so I'm a member of Barrettstown's summer team that's based in here for the summer, and I'm now in a position that I can support children who are kind of in the same position as me when I was younger.
So it's a lovely memory, and just what a beautiful photograph to have.
No, yeah, definitely. It's a cherished memory, I have to say.
Yeah. And an inspiration for you, obviously, for your own performances.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And even that, like, you know, the all sorts of advice and whatnot she gave me that night of, you know, staying true to yourself and whatnot. She's definitely just such a great character.
Yeah, absolutely. Ashley, thank you very much for that, for getting in touch with that memory. That is all we have time for today. Sean Marin was our broadcast coordinator. Harry Buckless was on sound, and today's show was produced by Dave Sherry. Stay tuned now for Ray Darcy.